This is Caffeinated Risk, the monthly podcast for security professionals by security professionals, focused on the principles of enterprise security risk management, exploring technology and business management issues and how they relate to information security risk. Once a month, two self-proclaimed grumpy security guys bring you analysis, insights, and interviews with leading security risk professionals to learn how they work through a project, a program, or their careers using a risk-based approach to security. Now, here are your hosts, Tim McCreet and Doug Leese.
Thank you, Martin, for joining the session today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. My pleasure.
Yeah. So can I ask you to introduce yourself to our audience and let them know what you're doing today, but also some of the work that you've been doing with ASIS and with the OSPA awards as well?
Yeah. So there are three parts of my life. So let's do the ASIS bit first, because currently I'm vice president of the ASIS Foundation. Very privileged to be part of that. And because I'm vice president this year, I take over in January as president. And there, the object of the exercise is to generate funding in order to undertake different research projects under the umbrella of ASIS that have an impact on the security profession and or security practitioners. And the second part is to award scholarships in a whole range of ways for people all over the world. And that's a very positive part of my life. I'm very, very pleased to be associated with the foundation. I have been for many years. And with my professional life, I do two things, really. By background, I'm a professor of criminology, and so I do a lot of research on crime and security issues. And indeed, that's been the most part of my career. And I've written a lot and presented a lot around the world. I've interviewed a lot of people in prisons about their perceptions of risk and security. And I've done a lot of studies and surveys and interviews and focus group discussions. Out of one of those studies came this initiative, the Outstanding Security Performance Awards, which I hold very dear to my heart. It's now in 36 countries and growing. And the idea of the OSPAs is an award scheme that's independent, involves all the different associations in every country, lots of different categories, and based on ethical principles. So the judges are chosen by the associations, they agree to mark to an ethics policy, they mark independently, they declare a conflict of interest on every mark sheet. You get where I'm going. The idea is to be different. And next year in 2024, the winners of each category don't just win their country, they qualify for the global awards. And the whole point about that is to put a spotlight on excellence. You know, security is not a trivial issue. If you get it wrong, there are serious complications and implications. And we don't take enough time to identify and think about what it is that makes different groups, different individuals, different teams, different initiatives, different products outstanding. And to throw a spotlight on outstanding performance is a much underrated part of security work. It's something actually I don't think it's been very good at. And so that's the idea behind the OSPAs.
Thanks so much, Martin. And just so folks understand a little bit about our relationship, I am, as the president of ASIS International this year, I get a chance to work with Martin and a number of the other groups across ASIS to move the message forward for security professionals globally. So we've had a chance to work together. And as I fall off my year, which is ending on December of this year, Martin begins his tenure as the chair and the president for the foundation. So I'm looking forward to seeing the great work you get a chance to do. And as everyone knows, as I finished my master's, the books I read for my master's were also written and compiled by Martin. So thank you so much for all the great work that you've been doing. I really appreciate it. I don't know if I appreciated all the extra books I had to read, because they're in my bookshelf over there. No one can see the backgrounds that we have here on the screen, but we've all got our books in our library. So I just want to thank Martin for helping add books to my library as well.
Hope you bought them.
I did. I actually bought them. Yeah, I bought them. So I actually have them. So yes, sir.
Yes. Yeah, we were commiserating before the show that authors and musicians don't get paid in this modern streaming world nearly what the work is. And I looked at what perpetuity your company has been producing for work and making available to the public. And yeah, I was absolutely amazed. There's a lot of vendors that we're going to track a certain aspect of security year over year. We have Verizon Data Breach Report, and Waterfall does one on physical security. But it's very, very tactical. And yet when we look at the perpetuity stuff, it's you cover a wide range of topics, and the papers I have read, these are all pretty serious surveys. I'm just kind of wondering, there's so much work that goes into surveys and stuff, but we take a lot of heat in the security industry for a lack of hard numbers that would demonstrate any kind of value to an organization. Now, these professional surveys that you've been putting together and others that we see out in the industry, like, how should we as security professionals be using these to better support our initiatives? Because the work's good quality.
Yeah, I mean, it does depend very much on the survey. I mean, the thing about research, there's a great, enormous amount of science behind research. Mm-hmm. How you ask a question has a whole range of issues and considerations that go into the wording and the focus. It's a very, very scientific area. There are master's degrees just on specific parts of how you do research. So it's a very, very skilled and complex area. I think the real point about the security world, and this is true as of the foundation, true as much as it's true of any other professional researcher, is the security world hasn't been built on the need to recognize and work from an evidence base. It's been very much based on the world of experience, particularly in law enforcement and the military. This is the way we've always done it, and therefore this is the way we should do it. And of course, what research says is, or a good evidence base says, why are you doing it that way? How do you know it works? What would make it work better? And put simply, even as I say those words, I'm thinking it's much more complex than that. But just put simply, and so the security world isn't built around that sort of thinking. So research has been a fairly marginal consideration. And yet any profession that emerges is based on a science, a reason why things are done in a particular way. The consequence, understanding the consequences of not doing it in one way. And so the first step is just to recognize the value of research, let alone surveys or the different methodologies mm-hmm. that can be adopted. And that is work in progress. It's certainly a lot better now than it was at the beginning of my career. And the fact there are more degrees, more master's degrees, more people doing PhDs in the specific area of security and risk and around it is building up that knowledge base. And there's also the Security Journal, which I've had the privilege of editing with Bonnie Fisher for many, many years, which publishes papers every quarter based on original research, which are refereed and science-based. And they, too, build up a whole body of knowledge, which is beginning to inform the way we approach it, alongside a growing awareness of the value of research, albeit that is work in progress.
Yeah, I have contributed to that conversation very recently, as has Tim. And like you say, it's not only emerging, but it's very difficult, because when I look at it at the academic side, we're expecting this kind of rigor. My master's part of that was around the gaps in the workforce and how we might solve it. And there's definitely an expectation in industry that people are going to come out of school trained to do something. And yet, realistically, they haven't even got to how to think about what they're going to do, let alone how to do what they're going to do. And we expect them to be job ready. It seems like we're still not quite there as to a path to create a security professional. Like, we know how to make a doctor. We know how to make a dentist. I'm not sure we know how to make a security professional.
Oh, it's very definitely just work in progress. I mean, there are good initiatives going on around the world on this. And it is an area where a lot of good progress is being made. And I think that is really, really important, actually, that, you know, one of the studies that I did last year, and it's a really important one, actually, we do every year. I do an annual study of the security sector. It's called the Security Research Initiative. Every year we do a study. And last year it was about security careers. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions we ask is, how do people end up in the security sector? And listen to this, the majority of people end up in the security sector by chance, by accident. Yeah. But when you ask people about why they stay in the security sector. They point to a whole array of really positive issues, things like chance to serve the public, to undertake something that's important, managing risk, fighting crime, a chance to work in a very varied job role, a chance to work in a sector that has lots of different opportunities and lots of different challenges, the chance to feel that you're part of something that's important and different. Listen to this. The salary is quite good. Many of the myths about security are based on a perception that is no longer the reality for a whole range of people working in different areas of security. And it's been wholly bad at communicating that. And yet, although people end up there by chance, we've got to promote the reasons why they're staying, because they're very good reasons to consider a career in security for many, many, many different people. I think one of the big things that's happened over my career is the transition in the thinking about security. At the very top level, this has been a move from seeing security about protecting assets. And the problem with the term protecting assets has been the two most important ones, finance and people, are looked after by different departments already.
Right.
And the transition that's been taking place, which has been alongside and incorporates ESRM, has been about seeing security as a contribution to helping an organization make a profit. Now, the minute you get into that conversation and you get into that sort of language and that sort of dialogue, it places security in a much better place. But the problem is, there's one thing to articulate the ways that this generates advantage. It's quite another to have people who are in those positions being able to speak with authority alongside very experienced business leaders in that way convincingly. That's a different journey, and that too is one in progress, but a wholly healthy different shift and attitude towards what security is about and why it's important.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I think that's one of the things that we've got to focus on these next few years is, what does it look like? What does the skill set for a security leader look like in the future? And I think this is just me, but it has to include the concept of understanding the business, being able to communicate, being able to understand the business. I mean, simple stuff like what's the profit and loss statement for your division or for the department? Like, do you understand the hiring process? Like, what you need to do to build up skill sets and to lead within your team? I think all of those things are going to become foundational. It's, you know, when we, Doug and I have had this discussion many times with other guests, is this idea that when we get a chance to talk to the executive, what do you say and how do you say it? That becomes critical, you know, especially if you want your program to be successful. You know, every organization has finite resources. How do you manage to acquire those finite resources?
Right. But there's another angle to this, I think, actually, that came out in a recent bit of research just about to publish on security culture. That being able to do this is also about getting credibility in the minds of other professionals at the top level, that you get it and that you're part of that business crowd, rather than something that sits on the edge that is involved with peripheral issues like risk and security. So it is one thing to say it, but when the very best deliver on this, they say that it enables a whole set of business relationships, a whole set of openings to influential positions and contexts and situations that come about through being able to do that well. So it has a whole range of important considerations behind it, but it's easy to say, it's much more difficult to deliver on. And I think the security world has been much better at saying that this needs to happen, rather than painting a path or establishing the routes by which new people will be recruited under this regime, balancing business with security type experience or military and law enforcement, however you want to put it, and the routes to educating those already in it to achieve these objectives. That's more tricky, easy to say, but trickier to do.
No, and I agree. I think we've got some great examples, you know, where I am sitting on the board, where members have come in And not only do they run this security program, but they've been asked to run other parts of the business as well, just because of the skill that they demonstrated or their business acumen in managing the security function at a global level. They've been given an opportunity to operate in other divisions and other departments. So I'm hoping that we see more of that, that the executives start to recognize the skills that we bring as professionals to the table and how we're able to manage a security program. Can I use those skills into other business areas? I think you can, right? I personally think that you can.
I do too. One of the good things, you know, Tim, about the OSPRs around the world, what it's taught me is the very best in security are very, very good indeed. You know, at the top level, the people who are outstanding and the teams and the organization are truly outstanding. I mean, there's some really, really, really good stuff going on. And it's quite deep. There's quite a lot of it as well. And the second thing to say is that this is true across the world. In every country, there are outstanding performers doing outstanding things in security in the context of their cultures and their laws and their ways of living. But so there's a lot of good to point to here. It really is very good, but there's a long tail and there are many who are not good at speaking up about it. I mean, I say this actually at some of the OSPRs award ceremonies, you know, sitting in those OSPRs award ceremonies are the people who are, many of them are finalists, many of them have got through a very sort of rigorous process, and there they are, the elite. And yet, not been very good at saying how good they are. Yeah. You know, the security sector is not good enough at saying how good it is. And in some small way, the OSPRs play a part in shining a light on that.
And I agree. I think I'll let Doug jump in as well with it. But a lot of times the reasons why is that we accept the work that we do, right? And we don't really ask for a lot of it. So it's a very Canadian thing to do, right? We just accept the work that we have to do and we carry on and do the work. You're right. We don't spend a lot of time documenting the successes. We don't spend enough time advertising the work that we do. And I still, you know, I have a chance to mentor some up and coming CISOs and have throughout my career. And the question I kept asking all of them is, well, how often do you get a chance to meet your executive? Oh, I present once a quarter and I have my slides and, you know, they get a chance to actually spend time. And I said, well, do you get to stay for lunch? And then it gets really quiet because the difference between giving the presentation and walking out of the room and sticking around for lunch is a perception the executive have of the value you bring outside of your function. And that's the one thing that, as to your point, Martin, is as you get better at the work that we do and the excellence that we demonstrate, you're right. I think we have to get better at it. I don't know, Doug, I haven't figured out a way to do that yet without sounding out of character. So I'm not sure yet. So
people like you are shy. Some of that signing. Yeah. But we must. People can't talk about themselves, but we can as a sector make a commitment, which is what the OSPRs do, to be honest, is about,
right,
of shining a light across the world on those who are truly outstanding. Sorry, Doug, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, that's quite all right. I seldom get invited to lunch, so I was thinking of myself in that CISO thing. It was like, that will never happen. But when I was, I read your paper on the security budget influence, and you know, the majority didn't feel like they had enough influence on the budget, and I'm pretty sure if you investigated every other corporate department, they'd say we need more money too. But I'm wondering, it wasn't really in the survey, but did you have any insights, or even things you're teasing out for later work, that go deeper than just the competing resources? I think it's kind of back to what you guys were talking about the lack of understanding of what we do. The organization as a whole and the security experts, do they even agree on the strategy and the risk tolerance for the organization? Because if they don't agree on that, it's not a surprise that the spending doesn't kind of line up.
I mean, one thing I would say, Jack, first and foremost, there's a difference between saying we haven't got enough money, and what we were trying to say there was how much influence do security professionals have over the budget, regardless of whether they got enough money or not. And it was significant that people didn't feel they had enough influence over the budget, and influence over the budget was a very significant issue. And this point again came out, that the more influence you've got, the more you're seen as important by other professionals in the organisation, and the more that you can influence practice. But this essentially comes back to how important does the organisation see security as a function, and how important is the individual in charge in terms of respect amongst the hierarchy. And really, there are two different points. They're closely related, but they're two different points. And a highly respected person amongst the hierarchy can bring the whole security function up. And of course, the reverse is true. I don't think it matters so much. There's not agreement on it. I think the real point is, what are the principles we're working from in order to get agreement and disagreement? That seems to me the real challenge here, about being clear. I mean, the fact of the matter is, and you know, I spent a lot of time in prisons in my career. I have to say, rather fortunately, getting out at the end of the day.
Yeah, I was going to say, just to visit, right? You were just there to visit, right?
Thank goodness.
Oh, man.
I mean, there's sometimes presented as a bit of a holiday camp or a hotel. My goodness me, they're not nice places to be. Even the very best, you don't want to be there. Trust me, they're not good. But what you learn from speaking to offenders is that they know, when they're approaching a premises, when they're targeting a premises, they know security will be there.
Hmm.
The question is it going to impact on their ability to get what they're after, nearly always money? And if they are able to get the money, are they likely to be able to get away without being identified or caught? They're the big considerations. And security that doesn't achieve those two things is no big deal in their eyes. So, of course, there's security there. The question is, does it work? And they taught me the importance of not having security, but having effective security.
Wow.
They opened a whole new world to me. You know, that I asked questions of, I remember doing a major study of bank robbers. And, you know, the fascinating thing about bank robbers is there's a lot at stake. Okay. Sure. And nearly all of them were, of course, there's security in there. Obviously, I know there's going to be security in there. You know, well, why do you do it then? Well, who cares about cameras? Who cares about screens? Who cares about alarms? Who cares about, you know, the question is, does it impact on their ability to commit a crime? That's the difference between outstanding security and merely measures. And of course, the skill set in risk assessing, the skill set in making things available, a skill set in making them work in context, a skill set in enabling them to achieve the objective of security, but enable the business rather than inhibit it, are all extremely difficult things to do. Security is a difficult thing to do well. It just sounds easy, but yeah, it very definitely isn't. And there's a big skill set there. I think my answer took me way beyond your question, Doug, but I was really trying to encompass it in a wider context.
Absolutely. And I think, I appear to drift off there. I'm making mental notes on that exactly what you're saying, effective security. And I love the way you boiled it down to say, is it going to impede them? And is it going to affect their potential to be re-identified and therefore face consequences down the road? If the answer to both of those is no, carry on. And
well, and oh yeah, and Doug, can I just add to that?
Yeah, yeah.
It can have the complete opposite effect. You have to be very careful that security doesn't work in their own interests. Can I just give you a very quick example, a very simple example?
Yeah,
So I said to this bank, so in the UK a while back, not right now, which is why it's easy for me to talk about, they had these screens that went from the counter to the ceiling to stop the armed robber jumping across the counter, right? And so I said to this bank robber one day, so before you went in the bank, did you know where the security screens? He said, yes, I did. I said, did the security screens affect the way you did the robbery? He said, absolutely. I said, in what way did the security screens affect the robbery? He said, I only rob banks with security screens.
Really?
I said, but that's not, I said, that's not logical.
Yeah.
He said to me, that's the trouble with people like you. You come in here and you don't understand the offender's point of view. And here was his point of view. When he's committing a robbery, the thing he's most worried about is an overenthusiastic member of staff jumping across the counter and accosting him. That's what he's most worried about. So if he goes into a bank, he can tell whether there are customers in there. And if there are, you can manage them. But you don't know how a member of staff's going to behave. So what does a screen do? Keep out of the way his biggest danger. So what he would say is, Of course, I love screens because they keep it out. I go in, I go with a gun, I say, give me the money. And if they don't give it to me, I'll go somewhere else.
Wow.
You know, the point I'm making is, just to be clear, there are many good things about security screens, many good things. I'm just making the point. We have to be careful that when if we put these things in place without understanding how they're going to work and what the impact is going to be on criminal behavior, then the dangers are enormous. And there were many people, by the way, who said they didn't rob banks because of security screens. The opposite is true. Of course it's true. I'm just trying to draw the point about the importance of understanding exactly the consequences of different measures in different contexts, because not only may they not work, they can actually work in the interest of offenders.
I think it's very impressive, like the kind of work that you've been doing. And I met with another English scholar when I started my master's, and he kept talking about this concept of the science of security. And to hear you say, in order for it to become a profession, it needs to be based on science. I think that's a very powerful message. Is it aligned with where the industry currently is as far as, you know, sales and regulatory and things like that?
Well, it's not aligned at the moment, is it? I mean, this is work in progress. And but I mean, it is, you know, the test of a profession is that not anyone can do it, that you need to have undergone some sort of scientific training. Let me put it that way. Professional training, if you will, based on some sort of evidence base that there's a logic or a thinking behind why things work and why some things don't work. And you know, the fact you can effectively leave prison and operate as a security professional says a lot. But here's the point, though. You know, people in prison, some of those armed robbers were very, very, very good at understanding risk. Some of those fraudsters, including the one that I work with, very, very good at communicating a point, deceptively, I might add, in his case. But you know, the skill sets here, when you put them in one, are very, very difficult to achieve. And it's easy to be good, and this is what I'm saying to this particular ex-offender, I'm good at assessing risk. Well, you was. But there's a credibility that has to go with it. You know, there's some sort of professional accreditation which says I'm not offender, I'm not dishonest, I've got a good attitude to work, good ethics, good culture. It's also part of this process of getting this world into a good place. And it seems to me the direction's good. There are many sort of people on that journey in different parts of the world, very progressively, and we should applaud that and throw a light on the big change that's taking place. And is taking place, and the move for the better security world.
Now, for those trying to learn this or catch up, I mean, other than buy your books, which is an obvious thing that we're gonna add some links to our website.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure how much that translates to sales, but we're not looking for a cut. You know, it's a lot of work. Are there other ways? I see a lot of security conferences around. I'm part of one myself here in Calgary. Is there much else that we can do besides continuing to beat the drum, or how would we amp up this progress, like move it from a work in progress to maybe picking up the pace a little bit?
I would say, by the way, I didn't know that you were in Canada, Doug. We've got, later this month, we've got the Canadian OSPRs, by the way, award ceremony. So next year, you know, look out
for those. There we go.
Let me tell you, the way I would say is everyone could get involved. I mean, Tim's set the ultimate example here as president of ASIS over the last year. And, you know, set a very good example of how you can lead, and you can, your three messages, Tim, kept being reiterated about, you know, how we can bring about change. And there is really, 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 really important that we open up the opportunity for people to get engaged. And, you know, we've spoken about ASIS today, which is fantastic, but there are lots of groups, lots of associations. And around the world, with the OSPRs, in every country, we go to all the ones we can find and say, you know, come and be a part of this. Doing some excellent work. And they provide the opportunity in different ways to get involved and to have an influence. And we shouldn't underestimate the power of the collective voice and the value of that collective voice and people getting involved and bringing about change. And as it becomes more dynamic and as it gets more different parts, so the value of people becoming involved and having their say is all the greater. So that's what I would really encourage and wish for people to do.
No, thanks so much. Folks, Dr. Martin Gill, thank you so much for being on Caffeinated Risk. We appreciate everything. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the latest podcast from Caffeinated Risk. Make sure you visit our website, caffeinatedrisk.com, to stay up to date on what we've been working on. Our website has bios of our podcast guests, posts about topics we're passionate about, and even a library reference material we find valuable in the work we do every day. And don't forget to subscribe to Caffeinated Risk on your favorite podcast service. This way, you'll be notified when we release our next podcast, and you can listen to our previous guests just in case you missed them. Thanks so much for listening to Caffeinated Risk.